too often in the current system, when we're doing change and improvement, we're making incremental changes to the current system. And a big part of what we need to do if we're going to create a different future is to create bold pictures of how the future can be, so that the changes that we are making are building a bridge to a different future, not just an incremental change from what we do today.
Welcome to Coming of Age, a podcast that is changing the conversation on aging. I'm your host, Donna Duncan, CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association. This season, season four of Coming of Age, we welcome an exciting roster of guests from around the world, thought leaders who are at the forefront of transforming seniors' living and care and are shaping the future for all of us as we age. Today, we're diving into one of the most pressing questions of our time. How do we make big change happen? We've known for decades that this pivotal moment of generational change was coming, yet health systems around the world are still unprepared. Why? And most importantly, what are the possibilities for change for the future? In this episode, we'll explore the ingredients for large-scale transformation in healthcare and seniors care. How do we create the conditions for bold ideas to flourish and to unite behind a shared vision of a radically better future? Joining us are two amazing leaders. Helen Bevan is one of the most influential thought leaders globally in large-scale change within health and care. Over her three decades with England's National Health Service, Helen has equipped leaders to deliver meaningful improvements. Her work spans more than 30 countries, blending innovative ideas with practical strategies to drive change in the most complex systems. Christina Kraus is the Chief Executive Officer of Health Quality BC and an adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia's School of Population and Public Health. Christina is a leader in using social change models and network theory to engage stakeholders and advance quality care. She's an extra fellow with Healthcare Excellence Canada and contributes to many organizations, helping to champion collaboration and culture as drivers of improved care. Get ready for an inspiring conversation about what it takes to turn big ideas into real, lasting change. Let's dive in. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Point Click Care. Welcome to both of you, Helen and Christina. Today, we want to talk about wholesale, large transformational change as we think about this demographic boom that every country in the world is trying to navigate. We've known that this moment of generational change has been coming, and yet systems around the world are not prepared. Would love your insights as to how is it that we found ourselves in this situation and what are the possibilities that we could be embracing moving forward. So Christina, why don't we start with you this morning?
You know, I think a big challenge that we have right now is the context within which we're asking people to work is different, and it has been challenging. And the pandemic led to a public who became much more engaged in the healthcare system, much more aware. And then on top of that, with the resulting staff shortages, the challenges we're seeing in access to primary care, challenges in access to emergency department care, people are experiencing the challenges in our health system here in Canada in a way that they haven't done previously. And I think the expectations that the public has for us to address this and to fix it are high, and they should be high. And with the advent of social media, the way I think the public has voice now is different than in the past. And I think we're seeing a very political response to health system challenges. And that means we are being asked to do things much more quickly, to fix things. And the fix isn't fast, unfortunately. And so I think at times we're moving to achieve a target rather than stepping back and actually looking at what do we need to do to get there. And I would argue that real change, true systematic change, really thinking through how we create the right context to support people to be successful is going to take time. And that time is a challenge because it's not matching with the expectations. So we end up with quick and band-aid solutions versus this whole system transformation. And so I think a lot about these days around the context in which we are working, both from the political, both from the communities, from the public, from the patients, from the family members, and then also what it means for those working within the system for them, and how do we create that right environment? And unfortunately, they are in conflict with each other at times. Helen, I'd be curious your reflections on that.
What I would add to that is that they need time and space. And I think that a big part of our problem currently is we don't make space for thinking differently, for experimentation, for trying new things. If we look at the history of the world and where breakthroughs come from, they come from diverse thinking. They come from people who have got different experiences or who think differently, coming from one sector to another. We don't value those spaces enough, in a sense that the kind of jobs that people in the health and care system do are so tough. Okay, we end up very, very focused on delivering the present. I mean, in England at the moment, we've got over 6 million people who are waiting for elective care and appointments in our National Health Service, and everything quite rightly is focused on making sure that people get access. And what we value is the day-to-day delivery. And I agree, that's really important. Big part of what we need to do is to think about a different future. Very often when we bring a group of people that work in primary care together and say, what's your vision for the future of primary care? And very often people can only think in terms of the current system of primary care with a few incremental changes, you know, because that's what we think primary care is. Part of what we need to do is to create, you know, situations where much bigger groups of people, absolutely, people with lived experience, people that use services, people that work in the system, but other voices too, and, you know, create the time and the space for thinking in different ways. Too often in the current system, when we're doing change and improvement, we're making incremental changes to the current system. And a big part of what we need to do if we're going to create a different future is to create bold pictures of how the future can be, so that the changes that we are making are building a bridge to a different future, not just an incremental change from what we do today.
Well, it's such a great point as we think about that, those larger pieces. And we have, I think, traditional structures within which the systems work. And yet, I liken the change that's happening in Ontario and Canada to a Jenga game, which is a game where you put little blocks on top of each other until it falls down. So that type of incrementalism really isn't sustainable. And what we need is clarity more on a jigsaw puzzle, where there's a really clear image of vision that we can all share and understand how the various pieces can fit together. And whether you do the outline first and then work from the outside in, how do we take that kind of metaphor, I think, as we think about bigger structural change in the system? How do we have these kind of discussions around bigger systems, structural transformation? And like, what do we mean by that? Governments tend to go to, okay, primary care is the issue. Emergency departments are the issue. Long-term care is the issue. Home care is the issue. And governments around the world haven't seemed to be able to figure out how do you look at this more holistically. Whereas when you talk to people in the general public who want access, I think they do have a more holistic view.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I think something that at least the Canadian healthcare system has struggled with is, what do we mean by quality? So we have created what we call the BC Health Quality Matrix, based upon some initial work done by the Health Quality Council of Alberta. And that creates a definition for quality and what each of the various dimensions are when we speak about quality. It includes access, actually. So access is a core dimension of quality of care, but so is respect, which is you know, how do we design care that reflects an individual's values, culture, what matters to them? It also includes appropriateness and effectiveness so that we get the outcomes that we're looking for and that we recognize each person as an individual and that we give them the best evidence-based care. It's also safe care so that we don't do harm, whether it's physical harm, emotional harm, or psychological harm, or cultural harm, as within the Canadian healthcare system, our Indigenous populations have disproportionately worse health outcomes than any other group. A lot of that comes from Indigenous-specific racism, and that's an example of cultural safety. But it also includes equity and efficiency. And what I've observed over the years, having worked in quality now for about 20 years, is that we tend to focus on one dimension at a time. So in the early 2000s, there was a huge push around access with a federal wait time strategy. Then in 2003, there was a big focus on safety. We had a huge safety movement that happened in this country, followed by a real recognition around patient experience, patient-centered care, respectful care, and so on and so on. And right now, the theme of the day or the quality dimension of the day is access. And what we tend to do is, whether we focus on one sector at a time as a priority, we also tend to focus on one quality dimension, maybe two at a time. And often what happens is we forget about the others, and then we start to realize, oh no, we've created an accessible system, but it's not very safe. And we have examples of that that have happened right across this country where we focus on one dimension at the expense of others. We often say you may be focusing on one or two dimensions, but you cannot forget the others in your design. And so they may be balancing measures so that we say we're going to focus on appropriateness and we're going to make sure we don't create a less safe system. And I find that whether it's quality, whether it's the sector, you know, priorities are critical, priorities are important, but we have to ensure that we have a way to at least watch the other areas that we're thinking about. We call those balancing measures and quality improvement so that there may be unintended consequences. And I think about long-term care homes in particular, but also the health system across this country in trying to do the type of change that Helen thinks about. I think an absolutely critical part right now is the context for the healthcare workers, or administrators or those working within the system. And again, we either tend to go with a very system-centered approach to design, or we really focus on a patient-centered approach and we tend to go all in, right? For, you know, the people who are living in long-term care homes or the family members and design. And the reality is it's a both and. And there's some very tangible, tactical things we can do around co-design. And I would say now our next step is to also look at the public in that co-design. We need to think much more comprehensively when we think about quality so that we can actually be much more purposeful. And I find sometimes that the timelines and the pressure that's on the system to deliver now, you know, we often talk about evidence-based clinical practice and clinical practice guidelines. We all agree that is the way that we need to go. But evidence-based change management, evidence-based quality improvement, at times is discretionary based on whether we have time for it or not. And I think that is why we are in the sort of challenging times that we're in today, is that we bypass what the evidence tells us we need to do because we're pursuing a target that we're having incredible pressure to deliver on very quickly. So we skip things and then we wonder why it doesn't work, why it doesn't sustain, or we don't actually achieve the potential that the change had in the first place.
Time really is a big factor for all of us, and every country is up against a clock. But you've also commented on some of that more purposeful balancing of how we move and drive change. Helen, I'm really curious, from your perspective, what's the secret sauce to allow people to imagine and develop a vision of a radically different future, and how do they get there?
Donna, one of the words that you use there is balance. And what strikes me about this whole agenda is there are so many contradictions and tensions in it. We've got to be able to work with both ands. So, like, incremental change is really important. incremental continuous improvement can deliver phenomenal results, but it isn't enough, okay? We also have to work with deep, profound change, okay? Delivery is really important. And at the same time, we have to have the time and the space for creating a different future. And I want to just tell you about a study that was done in our system in the NHS, which I think epitomizes the kind of the heart of this balance or tension or contradiction. Five hospital systems in England who took part in a big experiment, okay, to do whole system quality improvement. And they were all supported by the NHS nationally to take part in this experiment for 5 years. And at the end of that, there was an evaluation which was led by Dr. Nicola Burgess at Warwick Business School. What she basically found is that the places that got the best results, okay, the places that were the hospital systems that did best in terms of overall performance were ones that created the conditions, okay, for learning and sharing. So they were the organizations that they actually had the best delivery. They got the best performance because they built into their routines every day, okay, the opportunities for people to learn and share together. And they did it in a very deliberate way, okay? And in a sense, they valued the time, space for experimentation, for learning and sharing into daily routines. And paradoxically, okay, the places that got the best performance were the places that invested the most in learning and sharing. So they weren't the places doing 100% delivery every single hour, okay? They were the places that built the cultural awareness, that built the learning and sharing across boundaries. For me, a big part of creating the conditions for improvement and for large scale change is about valuing the investment in innovation, in different ways of working, in collaboration and in partnership, and understanding that those things are just as important as the focus on delivery.
And Helen, I know you've spoken in the past about the how do we build those systems for experimental learning? I know you've also talked about the importance of unlearning things. Was that an initiative that continues and that has been scaled further, or is it something that was a point in time?
Certainly the places that have got the continuity of leadership, okay, are continuing to move forward in a positive way. And again, it's another paradox. Actually, if we want to see kind of large-scale discontinuous change, actually having continuity of brave leadership actually creates the conditions where we can when we can do more radical continuous things. Yeah, when I look at those systems and look at where they are now compared to before the pandemic, they're all doing well. And also there was further research that happened during the pandemic by the Health Foundation in England. And it showed that those organizations that had already like invested in improvement, invested in learning, invested in cultural readiness for change were the places that had the relationships that they were able to shift and move and change things more quickly and more effectively.
Well, you've touched on a point around that comment around consistency and constant leadership. And I think not all people who have a title actually are leaders. And so you can actually have people within organizations who lead as well. And while we were chatting before this, Christina was commenting on health systems leadership. And I'm just wondering, Christina, if you want to add to anything that Helen's commented on, because I think it really is a key point.
Absolutely, leadership is not always positional or what your title is. But I do believe those who do hold titles or hold position in a traditional sort of hierarchical sense do have a disproportionate influence on the conditions for change. As Helen was talking about, you can't underestimate the influence even of one individual, whether it's one manager or one senior leader, and how you can have all the right conditions and a highly engaged staff. But if they hit a wall or what I call the senior leader wall, where they try to work in a different way, if they're not supported to work in a new way, it becomes very difficult to move the change forward. And I think it is the responsibility of leaders to create the right conditions for change. And that is valuing and creating the time and the space for meaningful engagement, a meaningful co-design, for people to have voice, to have opportunity to contribute, and to really listen to what people are saying. One of the a practical sort of approach to that can even be in journey mapping. So I think the patient journey mapping is a tool that people use and engage in the work. I think certainly the power of the patient voice is well recognized in the Canadian healthcare system. But we very rarely also map the journey of the provider at the same time. And so I often ask people, what did your healthcare provider journey map say? And often people haven't thought of that or done it because they're so wanting to hear the voice of the patient and value that. But when you think about sustainability of change, it is a both and. And I think Helen's theme of all of these things are a both and. But again, that's an example of a leader needing to value and create the space for that to happen. And that sounds like a small little thing, but it actually speaks volumes when you are a provider working on a unit that your journey is also important in terms of what the design looks like. And I do think now, as we are coming out of the pandemic, one of the biggest things we've observed is a significant loss of trust in institutions, a loss of trust in the healthcare system. And so we have to be thinking about now, how do we move out of that and start to rebuild trust in the system? And I think going to the public, going to communities, and as I think about long-term care homes and the amount of resources and assets that sit outside of the care home itself, that can enhance quality of care, can enhance experience. Have we thought of designing in partnership with a local community what the care home is going to look like? Have we actually engaged the public in that? And I do think we've been on an evolution in the healthcare system around how we exist with those we serve. And we went from initially in a clinical interaction to say that used to be, I don't know if any of you remember the non-compliant patient being a notation in a chart when the patient didn't listen to the instructions of the provider. And we started to realize that no, a shared decision and having the patient be part of that decision and making decisions together led to better outcomes. The reality is a shared decision is a shared outcome. And that is both when things go well and when things don't go well. And so we then evolved to say, well, we need patients and we need patient partners in our design. And again, so we started to have patient voices and people with lived experience being part of our design processes. And I think now the next level is to the public. And how do we open up and be open to hearing the voices of those who may not be currently receiving care, who may not have lived experience, but to say, with all of the challenges in our healthcare system, what matters to you as a community? What matters to you as a public? And how do we design in a way that represents that? I think will get us to a very different place. Circling back to the leadership, the leaders have to value that. The leaders have to say that the voice of the public, you know, and the voice of others into the design is critical, which means we as the health system are going to have to cede some more power. You know, we ceded power to the patients and then we had ceded more power to, right? And this is yet the next level. But I do think if we don't do this, it will be very difficult to rebuild the trust that we've lost. And maybe it's as simple as saying that leaders need to recognize that leadership is, who are leaders are not just those who hold position and title, and that they have to see themselves as creating the context in which people work so that those at the point of care, those who are family members, those who are caregivers, are able to be part of the way forward and what the future looks like.
One of the reactions, certainly, that we've seen in Ontario to the pandemic is a government bringing in enforcement investigations, the ability of the ministry to investigate and lay charges on people, and more actually being put into legislation as opposed to being put into policy or thinking about how you're actually going to practice things. So at a time when we need to evolve quickly, we've put everything into actually the vehicles which are least nimble to allow for that kind of innovation and change and even partnerships. In the pandemic, we had primary care providers and pharmacists and paramedics actually coming into long-term care homes to help. Hospital nurses and doctors came into our long-term care homes to help. We suspended legislation to enable those kind of partnerships and supports within the context of local community. And then we put them all back in. And if anything, we've actually reinforced those old structures that are really anchored in those more architectural silos. So buildings, a hospital, a long-term care home, or a supportive housing home, and then people's own individual homes. So we keep coming back to bricks and mortar and historic structures in how we think about a system. And what has been lost and had started to evolve in the pandemic really was more of that systemic interdependence, where we started to think about how we're going to support people in their community, keep them home, keep them safe. And so we defaulted back. Helen, as you think about the change that is happening in the United Kingdom, and I know both you and Christina are part of a global conversation around transformation, change, and quality. Who needs to be part of the conversation to perhaps help restore this, the trust in the system, so that decision makers and politicians don't automatically default to something that is probably more anchored in motive, and that's not a bad motive about safety, but to advance change that allows for evolution and transformation?
So I think it depends on what your view is of how you make change happen. Because if you're somebody at the top or the center of a system and you think about the levers or the tools that you have for making change happen, you know, you see the world in a very kind of top-down rules, laws, policy cascade. But, you know, when we actually stand back and we look at history, change isn't like that. And I wouldn't want anybody listening to think that the only thing that matters is top leadership. And again, it's another contradiction, you know, because top leadership and system leadership, you know, really matters. And if we wait for our top leaders to change, then we could have a very, very long wait. And I think, you know, all of us who care about the health system, who work in it, who use it, like, we've got a power to make a difference. Because if we like look where change happens, how it happens, it's not top down. It's not bottom up either. Actually, what we see time and time again is that effective change is a side-by-side process. And it starts when small groups of people with shared values or shared purpose, you know, come together and start to make a difference. And there's a really great example in England at the moment that I think is a fantastic example of this. We have introduced a process which is called opt-out testing. And basically what it means is that when people come to the emergency department and they have a blood test, okay, unless they object to it, everybody is automatically tested for HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C. And nowhere else in the world has it just spread like it has in our system. And soon we'll have 70 different centres all doing opt-out testing, and 6,000 people who didn't know that they had HIV, hepatitis B or hepatitis C, now know that they've got it and are receiving treatments. Okay. And why this has spread isn't because there's been some top-down mandate to say every emergency room has got to, you know, has got to do opt-out testing. We're making this the policy or the law, or we're putting financial incentives in for you to do it. People and places are doing it because it really matters. Like, where the idea came from, involved, or at the heart of it, okay, were a group of activists, HIV activists. And it started off with HIV, and it's now spread to Hep B and Hep C as well. like this side-by-side change process. Like nobody is saying to those clinical teams that are coming on board, you've got to do this. Like people are, like teams are like really wanting to do it. And it's just spreading in this kind of side-by-side, peer-by-peer process. And the other thing that's really important, I think, about this change process is that the people that are doing the testing, they get to know that they've changed a life or saved a life. The system's being set up. So somebody who's a phlebotomist, you know, who's drawing blood, actually hear back, what you did has really made a difference to somebody's life. I think this whole idea around shared purpose, around things that really matter in life, if we focus on the reasons why we're active around certain causes or we do the jobs that we do and we have a chance to come together with other people and change things, it's so much more effective, I think, as a enabler of change, as an energy for change, than top-down mandate will ever be.
Yeah, I mean, I think the opportunity to actually receive feedback around the impact of change is something that we don't do well. One of the best examples I can think of is the use of safety crosses on a unit and the display of data for those who are involved in care to actually see care. And this example is a little bit different, but we were working with a hospital here in the province where there was some significant current concerns with the staff mix, a new model around bringing in LPNs and care aides into an acute hospital. And what was starting to happen was there was so much fear around concern for patients that they wouldn't have the level of care that they needed and there would be safety consequences to that. And what was happening was if there was a fall, it was almost like a confirmation bias because people were expecting bad things to happen. And so there would be a fall and then the response was everybody's falling now. And so what we did is we worked with the staff who were also receiving, you know, patient safety learning system, which is the reporting system we have here, reports around, you know, number of falls being reported, number of medication adverse events being reported, and that they were coming 2 to 3 months late from the data folks in the health authority, and they didn't trust the data. So there had been a loss of trust between the frontline providers and the administration. And so, you know, we said, we're going to have you use a safety cross. And basically a safety cross is a calendar where the staff on the unit color in at the end of each shift whether or not a particular event happened. So we asked the nurses, what are you most worried about in this new staff model? And if for them, it was falls, it was medication errors. I can't remember what the third one was. And so we said to them, okay, at the end of each shift, somebody needs to write in the number of falls that happened during that shift. So for each day, a square was divided in half. And if no falls had happened or no medication errors had happened, they would color it in green, half the square. And if there had been a fall, they would color it in red and they would write the number that had happened. And so they started to collect their own data. And so very quickly, one, it was real time. So it was each day they could, and it was posted out on the unit for everyone to see. But they owned it and they could see what was actually happening. And what they found was that the number of safety events was not matching what they believed it to be. And so they started to turn around and start to say, okay, well, maybe it's not the same risk, but where we are having them, what actually happened? And to me, that's a transfer of ownership back as well as a feedback loop around really collecting data that matters. And it's another area that I see, if we go back to the theme around time, that gets skipped. So I'm seeing a lot of quality improvement initiatives right now where there's a lot of worry about the data burden to staff and having to collect data. So what's being said is, we know you're short staffed, so we're not going to have you collect data. We're just going to have you engage in the change. And what misses in that moment is that knowing how you're doing and knowing that you're actually making an impact is a key engagement strategy. Actually, if you look at the drivers for engagement, the drivers for energy of change, one of them is knowing and making a difference. And the best way to do that is to either get a feedback loop, like Helen's example really clearly showed, but also we can do that through tracking data. And we are finding now more power in going back to pen and paper data collection. A tick mark at the unit or whatever it may be, very simple data collection, thumbs up, thumbs down, a bowl where at the end of the shift, somebody says this was a thumbs up shift or a thumbs down shift to measure staff satisfaction. That's highly visible so people can actually see, are the changes we're making, are they making a difference in real time? So I think we can't underestimate that power of feedback. And that goes for everybody. It isn't just the providers and the system. It's also the patients we engage around making change. You know, how are we sharing information back to them as well?
Well, and that's such a contrast to everyone thinking that technology is the key enabler. So data, technology, but your data is only so good as the data you can actually use, and its timeliness as well. One of the things that we're seeing as trending right now, which I think really speaks to the opportunity for collaboration and more cross-system interdependence, is the issue of our aging demographic and frailty. So we're hearing that our emergency departments, their staff are actually not trained to support frail seniors. Guess who treats frail seniors? Long-term care homes, geriatricians, primary care providers. So I'm wondering, from your vantage point, have you seen anything emerge where there's starting to be a greater recognition, instead of everybody feeling that they need to build their own? How do we use what actually already exists in other parts of the system and use that better in support of those individuals, especially as we contemplate the transition of an individual patient across the health and social care continuum?
One of the things we need to think about, if I go back to sort of, you know, the topic of the day, which is around how do we foster large-scale change, there's a great model called Highly Adoptable Improvement that Chris Hayes and Don Goldman put together. And one of the things that he looks at in the model is perceived value. So how important is this to me? Tied together with workload. Basically, the premise is when you have high value and not significant increases in workload, you've got highly adoptable improvement. And what we tend to do is we tend to add on in our system. And we also tend to plan in silos in our system. And so we don't think about each other enough. So I can give you another concrete example. When we were doing our work initially around antipsychotics and long-term care, at the same time, long-term care homes were having to implement medication reconciliation from the accreditors. And we also had an initiative here in British Columbia from our shared care committee, which is a partnership between our government and the doctors of BC around polypharmacy. And what was happening is each initiative was reaching out to care homes independently of each other. And so the care homes were experiencing these asks as three separate asks and three separate processes. And so we actually came together and said, you know, we are all provincial organizations who are asking care homes to do something. And the reality is it's one process. It is the process of how we look at medications for those who are living in care homes. And so we actually tied it into one process, which was make sure you have an accurate list, look at how many you're on, and look at the appropriateness of the ones that you're on. And that became one ask to the care home rather than three. And so when you think about planning for change, we very rarely look at the journey of the patient, which is why I'm such a huge fan of journey mapping. Because if your patient's journey or your resident's journey crosses multiple systems, an interface with primary care, living in the care home, the emergency department, we are, I think, obligated to look at those journeys from the experience of the patient and also the provider, which means when we go to do the work, we have to move across the silos and break down those fragmented systems, because it's a classic example of a system-centered approach. And I think this is where, you know, even circling back to the beginning when Helen was talking about real change happens when you have diverse voices and diverse perspectives, we have to start to undo the planning from a system-centered approach, silo by silo, to actually a journey-based approach of those working in the system. Because the reality is those working in the care homes, if somebody leaves the care home and ends up in the emergency department, gets admitted to the hospital, is then sent back, they may see, you know, emergency department, they'll see specialists, they may have a hospitalist, and now they're returning back to a primary care provider and a care team in the care home. That information flow or the planning for that process is often done in individual segments. Some of the best examples of work is where we break down the silos, but also recognize that may mean, and planning for this, that a piece of work that somebody loves to do, we may be asking them to stop doing. I like 85% of what I get to do in my job. There's a good 15% that I really don't enjoy, which is like budgets and financials. I'm terrible at it. And yet I know doing that 15% enables me to get that 85%. So as part of the design process, the value that people feel is tied not only to the value to the patient, but also value to themselves. I think one of the biggest barriers we have right now is true meaningful collaboration across sectors, because we're not honoring and acknowledging what people are gaining, but also who is having to give up. And it may be something that they really value. I think we have to rethink how we do change and also look at the collaboration across sectors and recognize there's politics involved. Small p politics are there. But when you look at the models of care that we're trying to implement in a truly team-based care environment, and as I think about your example of the care homes in Ontario, where during the pandemic, we demonstrated we actually can do change very quickly. But there was a crisis. You can't sustain that pace of change either. And so it's, you know, how do we create the conditions of crisis without there being a crisis so we can actually test and be nimble, but also recognize that change is also gaining, but change is also giving up. We have to honor that in a more meaningful way than we currently do.
Helen, over to you.
So what I was thinking about, Christina, when you were talking is a word that Donna's used a few times, which is about interdependence and like interdependence within a system. To me, to be interdependent means that we've each got our own goals and things that we need to achieve, and we are reliant on other people to achieve those goals. And like we know when we are truly interdependent and in a system, because we can see that our partner's goals are as important as our own goals. Well, it absolutely starts with shared purpose. Because if we're only focused on our own goals, then, you know, we can be in a kind of winner or loser scenario. But if we truly understand that collectively we have a bigger purpose and we're all working towards that, actually means everybody wins at a higher level. The other thing I'd say is that all of us that are working in or contributing to the health and care system, we have to appreciate that it is a socio-technical system, okay? It's technical in the sense that we have policies and we have strategies and we have methodologies and processes and pathways and metrics, okay? All of those things are really important. It's none of those tensions. And at the same time, it's socio, you know, it depends on our ability to build relationships across systems, trusting relationships, you know, collaboration and so on. And one of the things that I see happening globally is a growing appreciation, okay, of the relational side or the relational aspects of large scale change. You know, at the moment in our system, we're very, very focused on improving productivity. Okay. What happened in the National Health Service in England is that our level of productivity post pandemic, you know, the amount of work we're able to achieve, like per person that works in the system, has reduced significantly. I think we get confused between efficiency and productivity, because efficiency is about like, how do we improve the process? How do we de-bureaucratize things? How do we take waste and variation out of the system? Again, really important things. But productivity is about some of the things that Christina was talking about. Productivity is about how can we enable each individual to do their very best work and to create the most value in the system. Productivity is much more. It's about morale. It's about a sense of agency. It's about motivation. And I think the relational aspects, the coordination and the collaboration, I think is like there's an understanding that is the kind of secret ingredient you know, when it comes to productivity. And, you know, we're talking about big change, but I think that small things can make a really big difference. Even if we're talking about a patient journey or an individual or a clinical team that make a contribution in that pathway, how can we think about what the person before does in the pathway or the process, or the person afterwards? How can we improve what we do that makes things better for them? One particular approach to this, which I think is really great, is called 15 seconds, 30 minutes. And it's my contribution to the pathway or journey. What can I do additionally that might take me 15 seconds that is actually going to save somebody else further on in the process 30 minutes? This whole idea around relational coordination, task integration, I think it's a really big component, both in small scale incremental change and in large scale change.
I have to think, each of you, both of you, the fact that we're having this conversation with Helen, you're in the United Kingdom, Christina, you're in British Columbia, and I'm in Central Ontario. The fact that we are having these discussions nationally and globally, and that we're sharing these best practices, I have to say it's been inspiring to come to know each of you and to see how well you work together and are having a common conversation as we think about driving change. You've inspired me. You've given me hope that we can do this and that the change is happening. Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so that more listeners will join our community of changemakers in seniors' care. Until next time, I'm your host, Donna Duncan. Keep well. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Point Click Care. Point Click Care is a leading healthcare technology platform enabling meaningful collaboration and access to real-time insights at any stage of a patient's healthcare journey. Point Click Care's single platform spans the care continuum, fostering proactive, holistic decision-making and improved outcomes for all. More than 25,000 long-term post-acute care providers and more than 1,600 hospitals use Point Click Care today. For more information on Point Click Care's software solutions, visit pointclickcare.com.